When the second edition of Karl Barth's Commentary on Romans appeared in 1921, it came under very severe criticism from Adolf Schlatter, one of the truly great New Testament theologians of all time. And he pointed out a very interesting fact, which to us interpreters is extremely important, namely that the comments offered by Barth in his work represented more his own views than those of St. Paul. Schlatter was perceptive enough to point out that Barth's stress on God as the Holy Other tended to remove divine activity from the realm of history, and that therefore the interpreter must attempt to discover something behind the words, which he called the Word, regardless of the specific content and terminology of Paul. Faith, said Schlatter, is not a leap into the void, as Barth would make us believe. Its object is described in the words and conceptualizations of Paul in such a way that the reader and interpreter of any age can follow Paul's thought processes and appropriate them for himself when he accepts Christ, as Saul of Tarsus did. Die Kirche, he argued, hat sich an ihrer Auslegung ernsthaft bemüht, die paulinischen Begriffe eindeutig und umfassend zu bestimmen. Now, we mention this matter here by way of introduction, not only because Schlatter, like our speaker, spent some time at Tübingen, not as a Fulbright scholar, to be sure, but because he insisted that the way to get at the meaning of a New Testament author is to go back to his day and to his age with all the historical tools available in order to unfold the meaning and application of apostolic thought for the church at any and every stage of her pilgrimage. Dr. Meek stands in that tradition. As his biographical data show, and they are available to you on the program sheet, he's very much at home in the world of Pauline thought. His particular area of interest has been and is the social world of early Christianity. And he's going to talk to us this morning on the subject of polis and ecclesia, explorations in the social setting of Pauline Christianity, by taking a look at some of the congregations which Paul addressed in his letters. So, Dr. Meeks, we're very happy to have you here. Now have at us, please.
Thank you very much. I must say I find myself a little bit astonished to be here, astonished to have been asked from that notorious den of heresy, Yale, but I have taken comfort in a word of Martin Luther, which I stumbled over one time in his Galatians commentary, in which he says, at this point, Paul is the most delicious of heretics. So, obviously, Luther writing that, and in full cognizance of all the people in the world of his time who regarded him as a particular heretic, I take great comfort in that tradition. And also great comfort in being compared, however remotely, with Adolf Schlatter. If I remember correctly, another one of the great sayings of Adolf Schlatter was that the act of believing must never be torn apart from the act of living. And in a way, that's what led me to the kind of social historical explorations which I've been trying to learn how to do for the last 10 or 15 years. For I felt that in the kinds of literature which I am perforce required to read a great deal, namely journal articles and books written by my colleagues in New Testament studies, that an atmosphere of utmost artificiality had settled on most pages, so that it was very difficult to see through the elaborate constructs which were read between the lines of New Testament writings and supposedly existing in the history of early Christianity, anything like what an ordinary Christian in the first century could possibly have identified with. At least I found great difficulty anymore finding any sense of reality to it. And so I set myself a number of years ago the rather simple question, what was it like to be and remain an ordinary Christian in the first century? This is different from asking after the great theological ideas laid down by the leading apostles. It is also very different from asking after the existential Selbstverständnis, which is inculcated by the kerygma, which always lies behind the words in which the kerygma may be expressed, but is not to be identified with any of those. It asks simply for a person living in Corinth, or Philippi, or Ephesus in the first century, what happened to you when you became a Christian? What did it look like when you wandered into one of those small meetings in the house of Prisca and Aquila, or in Titius Eustace's household, or in Gaius's in Corinth? What did you think was happening there when you saw this group of people meeting together and eating together? What would you have thought they were doing, which led you to come in the first place? Why did you come? Who invited you? Why would you accept the invitation? And what happened to you after you were there? I was very naive when I started asking this kind of question. I didn't realize that all of them were ultimately unanswerable. Yet I feel that the process of trying to answer them has led me to see what goes on in the pages of the New Testament with somewhat different eyes, and has at least opened the possibility of exploring something more like the reality of the first century. Naturally, I have been attracted more and more to Paul and to those anonymous people who made up the congregations to which he wrote the letters, which they probably did not understand. Because we know more about the Pauline congregations than any other group of early Christianity. That's perfectly clear. We have better primary sources. We have more primary sources. Not only is it true that we know more about Pauline Christianity than any other group in early Christianity, we know more about them. We have more better information about them than about any religious group in the Roman Empire. Think about Mithraism, for example. We have these wonderful monuments which have been dug up by archaeologists, but where do you find anything to compare with the letters of Paul in terms of the literature issuing from within the cult itself? Nothing to compare with this in any ancient religion. So while it may seem quixotic to go about asking sociological questions about any ancient group, it's somewhat less ridiculous in the case of Pauline Christianity than with almost any other group in the Greco-Roman world. I'd like to begin today by simply giving you a few samples of some things that I've been working on for the last few years. Hopefully, these will issue eventually in a book, though whether the book arrives before my retirement or the other way around becomes more and more a question. The book begins by asking about the context within which the early Christian congregations took their form. The answer is well known. It was the city of the Greco-Roman world. And yet it's astonishing how little that well-known fact has really had any effect on our exegesis. For years and years, New Testament scholars have divided up the world between Jewish-Palestinian culture and Hellenistic culture, as if those were two hermetically sealed-off cultural spheres. The more we've learned in this century and the more astonishing discoveries have been made in Palestine and elsewhere, the more we have found that that division of the world is false. It's a modern academic construct. But how seldom we have paid attention to the fact that Jesus and his followers were found in a rural and village culture in Palestine, and that from the point of the separation of the Hellenists scattering from Jerusalem within a decade after the crucifixion, Christianity's future lay entirely in the cities. Now, this was most remarkable and most important for the development of Christianity, because as Mikhail Rostovtsev, I think, was the first to point out, the urbanization of the Mediterranean world was a deliberate policy beginning with Alexander the Great and pursued ardently by the Roman emperors from Augustus through Hadrian. Civilization, of course, was identified with what happened in cities. Hellenization was equated with urbanization. And then in turn, as the Romans inherited the cultural mantle, Romanization also became a matter of urbanization. There were some very shrewd political strategies involved in this, as Augustus, who had learned something in this from his predecessors, began a policy of using patronage to find in each client kingdom, as Rome found itself almost accidentally becoming an imperial power, finding clients among the aristocracy of the city who, by becoming clients of the emperor and other leading families of Rome, would find that their own self-interest bound them to Rome and thus created a network of interrelationship which bound the empire together. Now, this had significant effects upon the culture in which early Christianity was born. The city was the place of change. The village is, by definition, conservative. As Ramsay MacMullen has pointed out in that wonderful book, Roman Social Relations, there simply is not enough excess energy and wealth in a village for anyone to seek change. You simply want to hold on to what you've got because existence itself is difficult enough. If there is to be change, then it must take place in the city. And therefore, people seeking change or people who willy-nilly are forced to change find themselves in the city. Furthermore, the movement, the change in the city is in the direction of a kind of universal culture of the Mediterranean world. A western half and an eastern half, to be sure. But there is a movement toward an urban culture, which even today, if you visit the archaeological sites, becomes palpable before your eyes. It is clear from the layout of every city that one knew what a city ought to look like. One knew what a forum was, one knew what a gymnasium was, one could find the inns and the taverns, and one recognized the temples immediately. As there was an urban architecture, there was an urban plan which was familiar. The glassware, the pottery, the way one carved an inscription, what the city council said when they wanted to honor a patron for his liturgies, these forms were typical of the whole civilization. And at this cutting edge of change, at this growing edge of change, was where the early Christians found their place. Now, in order to understand the birth of these small little cells of Christianity, one must, of course, think what sorts of groups one would find in a city. For one thing, for a long time, groups of foreigners had gathered in each city, merchants and artisans following the armies, or in search of better markets, persons enslaved and then later freed, political exiles, soldiers of fortune. Now, these non-citizen residents, metoikoi, in a city would often retain some sense of ethnic identity. They found themselves bound together by where they had come from and their common subculture, and the rallying point for them was generally, at least on the surface, religion. They bound themselves together by forming a voluntary association or a club. For example, if you go to the island of Velos, you find right alongside of the famous Lion Terrace the remains of a huge and very elaborate and beautiful clubhouse. This was the center of the association of the Poseidoniasts of Beirutus, of Beirut. Syrian citizens who had settled in the island of Velos in the 2nd century BC because it had become, from the sacred island of the ancient Greek Amphictyony, it had now become the center of trade and commerce, and where the growing point of Roman power would soon take root. These Syrians settled there. They formed a synodos, a club, and they gave themselves the name of Neptune, Poseidon, which after all was not exactly a Syrian god, but one as well at home in the Roman world as in the Greek world. And they built this enormous clubhouse in time. So did the Italian settlers. So did the Egyptian settlers. On Delos, you can still see the sanctuaries of the Egyptian gods. You can see the great forum of the Italians there. You can find the many inscriptions of the Italian club in Delos. And, of course, among these foreign groups that settled in each city, especially in each trading center and each transportation hub, were the Jews. The Jews also were organized as a synodos, as a club. When Julius Caesar banned the clubs from Rome, the collegia, he inserted a clause in the law that, of course, the ancient clubs, including the Jews, were not affected by this law. That is to say, legally, as seen by the Romans, the Jews were organized as a collegium, as a club, as a synodos. They were, in some respects, different from the others. There was a certain exclusivity about the Jews. Their religious trappings were rather different from those of the Poseidoniasts, particularly in their rigorous monotheism, which allowed for no compromise. If one were to be a member of this club, you could not also be a member of the Poseidoniasts, because you could not participate in any of the other cults if you were going to participate in the Jewish one. Now, in these clubs of foreigners, and particularly in the club of the Jews, as well as in many smaller voluntary associations, we find one model which an ordinary man of the streets encountering a Christian group in the first century might have to try to identify what these peculiar people were doing. For example, in every city we find merchants gathered together. We find the purple dyers of 18th Street in Thessaloniki, for example, forming a little club on 18th Street. They would meet once a month, presumably, for a banquet, take turns providing the wine or the sardines. They would arrange a burial fund to make sure that proper funerals would be conducted for their members when the time came. I dare say that the people meeting down the street in Ephesus, in the home of Aquila and Prisca, the tent makers, would look very much the same to an outsider. Another fact about the city, which we need to take into account, is that the city is connected with movement. First of all, physical movement. In the village, movement is on a very small scale. Ramsay MacMullan calls it a kind of Brownian movement. That is, the villagers move to town and back, take in their goods and sell them and bring home what they need from the city. They move to the next hamlet in order to make a complaint against their neighbor who has let his cows loose in their pasture, because he has to complain to the local magistrate and through him to the provincial governor, and then back again. There's this constant back and forth movement, but there is really no permanent change. But in the city, there's real movement. The famous inscription of the merchant from Phrygia, who recorded on his tombstone that he had been to Rome 72 times, is unusual but not unique. Travel in the first century of our era became easier and more common for more people than in any time before or after until the 19th century. This was largely because of the Roman police power, who managed to clear the Mediterranean almost entirely of pirates and to clear many of the roads of bandits, and because of the incredible engineering of the Roman roads. Ron Huck, in his recent book on the social context of Paul's work, has calculated just from the schematic itineraries of Acts alone that Paul traveled nearly 10,000 miles during the course of the career which Acts reports. Besides Paul himself and the companions who traveled with him, we hear often of his associates sent out on special missions in Paul's stead, of delegates from the churches sent to Paul, of travelers like Chloe's people who on the way bring greetings and news. The final chapter of the letter to Romans is replete with evidence of impressive physical mobility. Look at all the people that Paul knows in Rome and greets there. Where did he meet all these people, and why are they now in Rome? Obviously, the mobility of these people is extremely impressive, and this is typical of the urban population of the first century in our era. This was possible and not even surprising to the writers of the New Testament, because that's what was happening in the first century. Very much of the travel on land and sea routes, apart from the military and administrative operations of the empire itself, was undertaken by individuals for purposes of trade or professional advancement. Therefore, it is not surprising that the spread of foreign cults closely followed the movements of trades, or that Christianity itself also exhibited this already established pattern. Thus, not only in the island of Delos, but in the little town of Philippi, you find up on the mountain the Acropolis over the city. You find the sanctuaries of the Syrian gods, the sanctuaries of the Egyptian gods, the whole colony made up of Italian freedmen located there by Augustus. These are there because these sanctuaries of the Syrian and the Italian and the Egyptian gods, primarily because people have come to this colony in search of opportunities for trade. They've settled there, and they've focused their identity in the cult of gods familiar to them, although gods which increasingly take on the kind of universal flavor of the syncretistic world of Hellenism. It's more problematic to talk about social mobility in the Roman Empire, and much more difficult to assess its importance for religious change. It's important here to notice that the kinds of perceptions and attitudes about changing social status that we take for granted in our highly socially mobile society simply do not fit at all any society in antiquity. Once we look below the minuscule number of the elite at the apex of the very steep pyramid of Greco-Roman society, we see hardly any movement at all, in fact. One ordinarily assumed that every child would follow the profession of his father or the trade of his father. And that meant that his class and status were also hereditary. The ambition to rise above the class of one's father was exceedingly rare in antiquity. But perhaps it's more important to notice that in the early Roman Empire, it is not unknown. In the first century, and again in the fourth century immediately after Constantine, there are careers which are open to talents. I know in the case of the fourth century, as A.H.M. Jones has pointed out in a very perceptive article in the little collection of essays edited by Momigliano on pagan culture and early Christianity, the Christians were in an extraordinarily lucky place to take advantage of those careers open to talents in the fourth century. And the Christianization of the empire in the fourth century may owe as much to that as to any of the beliefs of Constantine. Now, I have a hunch, though I cannot demonstrate it, that on a smaller scale, something similar was happening in the first century. and that again Christianity happened to be at the right place at the right time. But as I say, I can't prove that. The point is that it is instructive to look at the few ways in which social mobility was possible in the Roman Empire. One of the places where movement took place was in that transitional state between slavery and freedom. Because remember, in Roman society, there is an in-between status. You can be servus, you can be a slave, or you can be ingenuus, you can be freeborn, but in between there is the libertus, the person who has been a slave and is now free. And that is a very strict legal status, a legal ordo. The person who was a slave and is now free is clearly superior to the slave, but still obligated to his former owner, who is now his patron. In numerous ways, both legal and informal, and he bears to the grave the more general stigma of servile origin, so that on his tombstone will be the innocuous letter L, which means libertus. That's part of his identity. At the same time, though he is stigmatized to the grave, he has special opportunities. While slaves, the liberti had often learned specific skills which enabled them to pursue a business or profession on their own after emancipation. There were some educational opportunities in a great Roman household which were not available to the free workers who had to scrape simply to keep body and soul together. It was very common for wealthy householders to use slaves and freedmen as agents in all sorts of transactions, particularly those in which it was considered unseemly for a person of high standing to engage himself directly, such as banking. A freedman might thus accumulate both considerable capital, for a slave was able, not legally but in fact, to possess a peculium, his own bit of money, not only considerable capital but also considerable skill in using it in order to make more money. It is understandable, then, that Macmullan finds among those few people who, by means of a craft or commercial activity, managed to gain relative affluence, freedmen stood out. In the inscriptions found in the Roman colony of Corinth, for example, there are names of several prominent persons who probably had followed this path to wealth, and then used their wealth in order to buy the political and social honors which finally give one status. Among them was an aedile named Erastus, who paves the courtyard of the theater in the latter half of the first century in return, as the inscription says, for his aedileship, for his being elected aedile. He is very likely the same Erastus that we read of in Romans 16:23, who holds the office of oikonomos tes polios, the treasurer of the city. Some Christians of the Pauline circle belong to one particular group of slaves and freedmen that constituted probably the most mobile category that can be identified in Roman society, the familia Caesaris, the household of Caesar, Philippians 4:22. Now, by good fortune for New Testament scholars, in the last few years, there have been several intensive studies of the inscriptional evidence of the familia Caesaris, notably P.R.C. Weaver, in a monograph by that title, Familia Caesaris. Weaver and others, as Chantran, and at least two other monographs published the same year as Weaver's on this, have documented with considerable clarity the restless upward movement of the imperial slaves. The clearest indicator of their enhanced social power is the tendency of slave-born members of the imperial household to marry wives who were free-born, a kind of marriage which is almost unknown in the rest of Roman society. That is to say, these people had enough prestige that though they were stigmatized as liberti, because of the enormous power and wealth which accumulated to them because of the offices they held as really the people who ran the imperial bureaucracy, that free women, in one or two cases of senatorial houses even, were willing to marry them. So these people are extraordinary exceptions to the general rule that there is no social movement in the Roman Empire. The rise of these freedmen aroused deep resentment among many people who thought themselves their betters. When Pliny the Younger, a half century later, saw a statue which had been erected to Pallas, the freedman who was financial secretary of the Emperor Claudius, he was so outraged that this former slave would be honored by a statue that he wrote not one, but two letters to his friend Montanus, complaining vituperatively about this servile-born fellow who had risen above his rightful place. The irony, of course, in all of this was that Pliny's family had also been parvenus, though they had arrived long enough ago that Pliny felt himself secure in the inherited wealth which he possessed from his famous uncle, and therefore he could look down his nose on the people who more recently were making the same trek. What the critics found so outrageous, you can see this again and again in the satires of Juvenal and Petronius, was the crossing of social boundaries. These parvenus dared to claim the status which their education, intelligence, skill, power, and wealth would give them, but which were forbidden by their birth, origin, and legal rank. That is to say, there was a crisscrossing of categories. And people in the ancient world, especially people in the aristocracy, found that was unfortunate. Now, I'll come back in a moment and talk a little bit more about this crisscrossing of categories, because it's one place, one of those rare places, where I think modern sociological theory can help the historian to understand what was going on then and clears up a very old problem about the social constituency of early Christianity. At least it puts new light on it in quite a different way. Let me just mention in passing, though, as we talk further about what the social structure of the city was like into which Christianity was injected, there's one other group whose crossing of categories evokes a great deal of comment in antiquity. That group is women. Among those persons who crossed categories in order to better their lives, even at the cost of enduring some obloquy from the neighborhood gossips, and presumably some internal tensions within their own families and within themselves, a great many of them were women. The hierarchical pattern of the family was alive and well. The male was always superior to the female, as surely as parents to children and masters to slave. This was deeply entrenched in law and in rhetoric, and its erosion was constantly deplored by the rhetorical moralists and the satirists. The various monographs which have been written in recent years about the so-called Haustafel in the New Testament bears ample witness to this. Nevertheless, there were more and more opportunities for some women to break through this pattern in the time of the empire. The most conspicuous examples, not surprisingly, come from the upper classes, like the Empress Livia, who is called by Philo because of her paideia, because of her unusual education, a woman male in her thinking powers. But opportunities were not altogether wanting for women also of lower standing. Inscriptions show that women were active in commerce and manufacture, and that like their male counterparts, they used some of the money that they made in these ways by giving benefactions to their cities in order to gain recognition and social status. In Pompeii, for example, a woman named Eumachia, whose family made their money in a brick manufacturing concern, therefore this is not old landed wealth, paid for one of the major buildings and donated it to a workmen's association. She held the title of sacerdos publica, public priest. Another Pompeian woman, Mamia, built a temple of the genus of Augustus. Throughout Italy and the Greek-speaking provinces, a small but significant number of women are mentioned on coins and inscriptions as benefactors and officials of cities and recipients in return of municipal honors. Note this also. I mentioned earlier the clubs, the voluntary associations, which were springing up like weeds in all of the cities where in every neighborhood people sought some congenial group in which they could join to eat and drink and be assured of a proper burial. Women also joined these clubs, usually the same clubs as men, because clubs entirely for women were very rare. But perhaps more significant, fairly often in imperial times, a woman would be asked by a club to serve as its founder or patroness. That is to say, she would provide money for a building or allow the club to meet in a room of her house. She would provide an endowment to provide for the food or for the burial expenses and so forth. In return, she would be given a festival on her birthday. She would be given wreaths, perhaps a statue. She would be given the first seat in the triclinium, in the dining hall where the group met, and so on. It's interesting that among the clubs that asked women to do this were also religious associations, cultic associations. The most famous one, I suppose, is the one which was organized in the household of the senatorial woman Agrippinilla, and which is recorded, some 440 names of the members of the association. This was a cult of Dionysus, north of Rome, recorded in a great monument which now stands in one of the ante rooms to the lobby of the Metropolitan Museum in New York. Agrippinilla is, of course, at the top of the list. She is the high priestess. And then there's her daughter and her son-in-law and all the various uncles and aunts. They also have high office. And then you come on down the list and you have Agrippinilla's slaves and various clients and so on also on the list. That is, she's made her household into a cultic community. The interesting thing is the number of inscriptions which have turned up. There are a few, especially in Asia Minor, in which the Jewish synagogue is supported by just such a person, oftentimes a person who is not a Jew. Need I remind you of Lydia the purple seller, and of Prisca and Aquila, of Philemon and Apphia, the church in their house? Again, we have a phenomenon which is common in the time, being pressed into service to provide meeting place and funds for the earliest Christian communities to meet. I've sketched out here a few of the aspects of urban life that need to be understood at much greater depth and on a more intimate scale than the grand generalizations that occupy the introductory pages of most New Testament commentaries. After that, then, the task becomes the discovery of ways in which the earliest Christian congregations adapted to that social structure of the city. Let us begin with as simple a question as possible. When Paul and Silas, Timothy, Titus, and the others arrived in a city in order to preach the gospel, where and how did they begin? How did they make connection with those who would listen? The cities where Pauline Christianity took shape were physically quite small compared to modern cities, and I think that fact is important. One of the metropolises of antiquity, one of the four largest cities, was Antioch of Syria. Well, you can walk around I only walked halfway around, but one can walk the circumference of the ancient city, which is probably 2.5 times the size of the modern town of Antakya, in an afternoon. And yet, upwards of 500,000 people were in that space, whereas today, somewhat less than half of it would, at a generous estimate, have 75,000. As I say, the population was exceedingly dense. Wonderful, magnificent public spaces, grand boulevards, you know, the great street with porticos, which was donated by Herod the Great, the main street down the center of Antioch with all the porticos on each side where they had little shops. Marvelous public spaces, so that life was lived, as it is in modern Mediterranean cities, largely in the streets and sidewalks and porticos, but where people lived, huddled together, crammed together in a density which today you would find only in the worst slums. Now, what does this mean for the kind of way in which a new cult, new ideas, would spread? First of all, it says that there's not much privacy, that it's very difficult to sneak into town, as Agrippa found out when he was going to pay a very quiet visit to Alexandria, remember. And he came ashore at night, and he was going to slip in and slip away again the next day. Instead, there was a riot, and the pogrom started, and so on, that Philo tells us about. Nothing much happens in the ancient city that people don't become aware about very quickly. You don't need electronic communication. Gossip at the village well is quite sufficient. Acts gives a tiny glimpse of one way that Paul and Silas found an audience. Whether it comes from a source close to the event or from the author's imagination really makes little difference for our immediate purposes, because the author knew what a city was like. In Philippi, the missionaries went on a Sabbath outside the gate to the riverside, where we suppose there was a place of prayer, pasoche. Later, the same author tells us that in Corinth, Paul found a Jew named Aquila, who with his wife Priscilla ran a tent-making shop. When a stranger arrived in a city, then, it is taken for granted that he knew or could easily learn where to find immigrants and temporary residents from his own country or ethnos, and practitioners of his own trade. Nothing could be more natural, because those were the two primary factors in the formation and identification of neighborhoods. People of the common ethnic origin flocked together. People of a common trade lived on the same street. Below the level of the ethnic quarter and the neighborhood of similar trades came the individual household. Our sources give us good reason for thinking that it was the basic unit, the household, in the establishment of Christianity in a city, as indeed it was the basic unit in the structure of the city itself, as the Hellenistic moralists never tire of telling us. If you destroy the city, you destroy the polis. If you destroy the polis, you destroy the whole cosmopolis. We must remember, of course, that when we read about the oikos in the New Testament, the household, when the New Testament tells us of the conversion of someone with all his or her house, that house is much broader than our concept of the nuclear family. It is defined in the first instance not by kinship, but by the relationship of dependence and subordination. The head of the household was responsible for and expected a degree of obedience from a great many people besides those who belong to his intimate family. Also his slaves, his former slaves who are now his clients, his hired laborers, sometimes his business associates, his tenants who rent out rooms in the outer parts of the houses. And therefore, to become part of a household was to be part of a larger network of relationships of two sorts. Within the household, a vertical line of relationship, not quite unilinear, but a chain connecting unequal roles, from slave at the bottom to paterfamilias at the top, in the most intimate strand, but also including the chain client to patron, and a number of analogous but less formal relationships. And second, networks connecting this household and others, links of kinship and links of friendship, which, of course, also often entailed obligations and expectations. I've already mentioned the voluntary associations, which were another form of social relationship very important in the Greek and Roman cities. And I simply remind you again that the household and the voluntary association, the club, could often be linked in one unit. That is, the club might be meeting in a household, which was the head of which was the patron of that club, or indeed it might be, as in the case of Agrippinilla, identical with that household, which now met as a cultic association. The ecclesia that gathered with the tent makers Prisca, Aquila, and Paul in Corinth, or Ephesus, again, would look very much like that to the neighbors. One final thing before I go on to try to give some samples of more specific social facts that we may look for in the origins of the Christian congregations. And that is that while I've been talking very generally about the city, it is also important to remember that each city has its own characteristics. And we have to pay close attention to those characteristics in as far as we can find them out of each city and of each region in which the Pauline mission was carried on. The places where we have some evidence from our first line of sources, the letters of Paul and his school, for the persistence of Christian communities sometime after the initial evangelization are irregularly distributed along a rough arc from the middle of Asia Minor, across Macedonia, and down to the Peloponnesus. In size, they range from rather small towns like Philippi to sprawling cities like Ephesus and Corinth. But they were all cities, poleis, in government, in culture, and in the feelings of their inhabitants. Two of them are Roman colonies, Philippi, Corinth. But those two are of very different types. Philippi is an agricultural community. Corinth has virtually no agriculture, but is a manufacturing and trading center. Both of them have as their official language Latin, though it's Latin surrounded by a sea of Greek in both cases. And in Corinth, for example, there's an abrupt change in the inscriptions dated from the accession of Hadrian. Up until that time, all public inscriptions are in Latin, almost without exception. But Hadrian, it suddenly reverses, and almost all of them are in Greek. Everybody in Corinth changes language overnight? No. There was the official language, and then there was the language everyone spoke, obviously. So one has to be aware of these subtleties in the evidence as well. The problem of Galatia is notorious. The Galatians were city dwellers too, but which cities? If we were to be convinced that the Pisidian cities of Antioch, Iconium, and Lystra, Sir William Ramsay's solution to the difficulty of Galatia, if that were to be accepted as the places that Paul meant by Galatia, then we would add those to our list of colonies, and we know rather a great deal about Pisidian Antioch and Iconium and Lystra, thanks to the very detailed study done in an Oxford dissertation by Barbara Levick a number of years ago. But more likely, the Galatians lived in Ancyra, Antavium, and Pisinus, perhaps, the old tribal kingdom of the Gauls or Celts. In all these cities, except the two colonies, Philippi and Corinth, the dominant language is Greek. And even in those two cities, there was a substantial population for whom Greek was the normal language. All of them except Philippi were centers of trade. And even in Philippi, there are reasons to think that alongside the Italian farmers, there were a good many foreigners who made their living by trade, like Lydia, the purple dealer. Every one of the cities is well located for access by sea or land or boat. Even the towns of northern Galatia, which seem to us indescribably remote up in the highlands of Anatolia, as a matter of fact, were connected with the metropolises to the west and south by excellent Roman roads. Such were the cities of St. Paul. I submit that the more we learn about them in detail, the better our position will be to make inferences and judgments from the New Testament sources about the nature of everyday Christianity in the first century. Let me pause at this point to see, I've been rambling on here uninterruptedly, and see if there may be some questions or suggestions or ideas from you before I then give a sample of one kind of question that we then proceed to ask our sources against this background.
Any questions from the audience, Roy?
Yes. When you were making the distinction between village life and city society, I was wondering whether in the ancient world there was any kind of constant interflow between the two, such as you have in the urban areas in Africa. People generally keep their contact with their village structure, and certain members of one family may be pretty well ensconced in the city, but they keep their ties with the village. Is that the case in the ancient world or not?
That's precisely the kind of question which we need to ask, and astonishingly, it's very rare for any of the people who take ancient history as their discipline to ask that kind of question. Ramsay MacMullan is the only one I know of who has seriously asked that kind of question, and he has only very general answers to it. One would suspect that there is oftentimes that kind of connection, And there seems to be evidence in some areas, such as North Africa, the kinds of things that W.H.C. Friend tried to do in making the sharp distinction between village culture and urban culture there. And then other people came along, like Peter Brown, and said just the sort of thing you're saying that tends to undercut that radical distinction. There certainly was movement back and forth. There was, the village absolutely depends upon the city in imperial times for market, for government, and so on. And therefore, they are dependent upon the city. The city obviously is dependent upon the hora around it to live for its food. So there is a symbiosis, and that involves people moving back and forth constantly. It's a very unequal symbiosis, it seems. That is to say, the village people always get the short end of the stick. And increasingly, MacMullen has collected the evidence of just what people say about one another. And the people in the villages see the city as extortionate, as brutal, as dangerous, and so on. And the people in the city respond by talking about those ignorant clods out in the hills. There is symbiosis. It's unequal, and it's much better for the city than for the culture. There is also a very sharp difference of language. That is, the city is Greek-speaking in the areas that we are interested in, whereas you move just outside the city gates, and very quickly you are in a sea of native language. Even down in the time of John Chrysostom, you have, he mentions in his sermons, the people who come in from the village and they can't speak Greek and can't understand them and so forth. And therefore, that's a limitation to the kind of interconnection which you're talking about, though I presume this would also have analogies precisely in the African situation where you have the tribal language and you have the governmental language. I would think that would be precisely the kind of model which one needs to think seriously about and to look at the kind of work which has been done in modern African society as one possible model for suggesting the kinds of questions that ought to be put to our sources.
In the military who were settled in various colonies, the whole legions were settled in North Africa in various places, the defensive purposes as well as the farmers. Now, social mobility certainly did exist there.
Yes.
And the ties with farmer relations were simply cut. It didn't exist. It was forgotten.
Yes.
So we don't seem to have a consistent model in this. Take Spain, for example, which spreads from the number of emperors, as you know. Now, the social ability is notable in the ancient times, and they were not conscious of connections with their, let's say, antecedent places of origin, etc. According to the evidence we have, it's rather scanty. They seem to be rather conscious of their independence.
That's right. And very proud of their Italian, of their Latinism in this foreign place, for example, in Philippi. You get that very clearly, and it's revealed in the inscriptions. Barbara Levick has studied some of that, the advance of the military colonists in these colonies which were founded in Pisidia and Lycaonia by Augustus. And she has traced several families through a number of generations of precisely this sort of thing. An Italian farmer went into the army, and then after the war, he is pensioned off and made a colonist in Pisidian Antioch. And then he works and establishes himself there. He gives his son an education. The son then is elected to the city council. And on it goes. Then the next generation, he's a senator and makes his way back to Rome as a senator. This happens occasionally.
He really wasn't inhibited severely through the decrees of Diocletian,
would you say? Well, Diocletian is another problem, because, and past my day, that's modern times, you see, I don't deal with that. now, one of H.M. Jones's points in this article that I mentioned earlier is that Diocletian, in reorganizing the empire, also creates the need for a very large body of trained bureaucrats, and he hasn't got any such. And when Constantine comes into power, there is an enormous shortage of trained manpower, And it just happens by this time that the one organization around that has been training people with these kinds of organizational skills for several generations is the church with its bishops' schools. And thus you have the extraordinary thing that suddenly these people who a few years ago were being hunted down as enemies of the Roman order are now being invited to come in and run the bureaucracy. And he gives us an example of enormous opening for social mobility for people who come from the lower classes and have gotten the training outside the normal schools of rhetoric, sophistry, and so forth, which usually was supposed to provide these kinds of expertise. And the church sort of from underneath suddenly is there with the manpower when they're needed. So he would see Diocletian as kind of unconsciously creating the situation in which a sudden new kind of mobility enters the empire. But that's another topic, I think. I haven't talked much about the military mobility. Military is one of the primary ways of social mobility of people who do not belong to the elite in the first century and throughout the empire. It doesn't seem to have any effect on early Christianity. A bit later, already some people say Theodore Clouser's written an article in which he thinks this is happening already under Marcus Aurelius, surreptitiously. And a bit later, this becomes a very important thing. Tertullian writes about the soldier's wreath and whether you can take the soldier's oath and so on. So it becomes an issue on both sides later on. In the first century, I don't see any connection. I don't know of any soldiers in the Pauline congregation, so I've ignored that whole area and have tried to look at the other kinds of mobility. Yes. The general answer to your question is, yes, there are very particular kinds of mobility. And these are the exceptions within the normal lack of expectation of mobility in the society. But precisely these exceptions, this was really my point, precisely those exceptions are very interesting to us when we start looking, and that's what I want to do next, we start looking at the kinds of people who are prominent in the Pauline congregations. My thesis is that they're precisely people who fit into those exceptional roles.
Fred?
I believe that it is often said that in his reportedly negative attitudes toward women, Paul was a child of his times. Now, you had some interesting references to rather prominent positions that women occupied, even the sacerdotes publica. How would this status of women figure into that kind of argument about Paul being a child of his time and his attitude towards women?
Well, there are two things to be said about that. One is that the attitudes of the time are somewhat confused. There are very specific examples which can be cited of women who are crossing boundaries and who are gaining prestige and freedom to move about. Women who are merchants, women who have high office, women who are patrons of societies, and so on. On the other hand, you have a very strong negative reaction to that, which is seen especially in the aristocratic literature and the satirical literature, which represents generally a conservative status quo position. That's one of those ways of crossing boundaries which is seen as destructive to the society, because society means a nicely ordered hierarchical society in which everybody knows his place and therefore we have stability. So you can, depending on which you cite, you know, you can cite the inscriptions which show that the women were in fact doing these things, and then you can cite Martial and Juvenal and Petronius and so on, that women must not do these things. The point is, you don't say women must not do these things unless they're doing them. So which side is Paul a child of, you see? I want to make the point, I have argued in another paper, that Paul in fact is a child of the former, the child of that part of the culture which is changing rapidly. If you, in fact, look away from 1 Corinthians 14 and look away from the very vehement reaction in 1 Timothy, and never mind 1 Corinthians 11, 2-16, because nobody knows what it means anyway, the fact is, actually I think including 1 Corinthians 11, 2-16, particularly if one understands what it's talking about, look at the roles which women, in fact, hold in the Pauline communities. Look at the women that he names as my fellow workers. Those people who have struggled together with me in the gospel, even though at presently they're falling out, Euodia and Syntyche, Philippi. Look at the role of Prisca. Why is her name mentioned before Aquila? Higher status, stronger role in the Christian community. These sorts of things. Look at the way in which Paul modifies the traditional rule about marriage, monogamy, and porneia in 1 Corinthians 7. He quotes the tradition, he says it's a tradition in 1 Thessalonians 4. Let each have his own skeros, his own vessel. Each one will possess a vessel, his wife. But look how he quotes it in 1 Corinthians. Let each man have his own wife. Let each wife have her own husband. And right on down the line, this monotonous repetition of the balanced clauses, so that every rule which is laid down for the man is also laid down for the woman and vice versa. That's quite extraordinary in its environment, seems to me. So I think one can make a case. Paul is not a feminine liberationist. One doesn't have to be so crassly anachronistic as that. But in terms of what was going on in his own time, I don't know what Paul himself thought, but what was going on in his communities was that women had roles in the mission and in the local communities, which in the environment were quite extraordinary.
Dave?
Gary, I have one step further. You implied in talking about the household that there was a very strict order of subservience. Mm-hmm. And yet, I believe there are some recent studies which have indicated that within the household itself, women exercise rather considerable authority, indeed to the point of retaining possession of their own fortunes, have the right of divorce, and taking the fortune with them, setting up their own
yes.
household. So
yes.
that, especially in imperial Rome, if I recall, studies
yes.
by Paul Martin and others, that the status of women in the imperial period was not as subservient as perhaps is implied.
Well, that's absolutely true. In contrast to the old Roman law codes, the authority of the paterfamilias has loosened up enormously, and women are able to inherit, women are able to be heads of households, and we have a number of them mentioned in the New Testament as heads of households. They are able to operate their own businesses. Lydia the purple seller again, Prisca and Aquila apparently on equal, are at least equal in their business, and so on. Yes, that's quite true. And that's why I say, if you ask, you know, whether Paul is a child of his time, you have to ask which aspect of what's going on at the time, because you do have these changes in the society, but you also have very conservative reactions to those. And it's those conservative reactions, because it's found in the literature, which has come down to us, that we most often are aware of. The legal situation is changing.
Any more?
Let me give you an example, then, of another kind of thing. Let's see, I believe we're supposed to break at 10:30?
Yes, sir.
You warned me. All right. I'm keeping a close eye on the watch here. For that, I would like, what I'd like to do for the remainder of our time together is to give you some very brief samples of the kinds of questions which I think are appropriate to ask, which can be asked, given the kinds of evidence that we have. Primarily from the Pauline letters themselves. That's just about the only kind of evidence we've got. And then to save a half hour at the end in which we may discuss the question of the theological implications of this kind of social historical work. At that point, I hope to be enlightened by you. But between now and the break, let me suggest that we continue to talk about the question of social mobility and the status of people who joined the early Christian communities. In the second century, as you know, Celsus wrote this book called The True Word. The first person of literary status to take Christianity with sufficient seriousness to write a book against it. And Celsus comes down very hard on the lower class origins of Christianity. He says these people are a bunch of wool workers and cobblers and laundry workers and the most illiterate and bucolic yokels. And they go around ensnaring children and silly women and dragging them off to their meetings in some shop somewhere. Now, until very recently, most modern scholars have regularly agreed with Celsus that early Christianity was a proletarian movement. This was very attractive to the Marxist writers on Christianity in the early part of the century. It was also very attractive to Romantics, who have written histories of early Christianity, the most important of whom has been Adolf Deismann in his book Light from the Ancient East and in his book on Paul. Though Deismann himself had difficulty placing Paul exactly, because he knew that Acts said he was a Roman citizen, and that didn't quite fit. As Deismann, you know, had wandered around in the streets of modern Tarsus, and he had found a little weaving shop there, and he waxes eloquent for several pages on the wonderful poverty of this weaver who is there with his hands stained with dye, and he's working at this ancient loom as his father and his grandfather had before him. And Deismann sees Paul in a similar alley, you know, weaving tents. Well, never mind that, you know, now that the tents were probably made out of leather instead of cloth. But anyway, that represented for Deismann what a tent maker must have been in antiquity. Just the poverty-stricken, barely subsistence level, and so forth. But if that was the case, then how did Paul get to be a Roman citizen? And besides that, if you read Paul's letters, Deismann wanted to make out that we have to understand the letters on the basis of the papyri, which had been discovered in Egypt. And these papyri give us for the first time insight into what ordinary people would write to one another in letters. But Deismann was honest enough to say, in kind of an aside, well, as a matter of fact, Paul's letters really aren't quite like that at all. Paul's style is very much higher than that. The letters are very much longer. They're very much more eloquent. They're very much more rhetorical. And then he closes the aside and he goes on and says, we must understand Paul's letters as real letters, just like the papyri letters and so forth. He doesn't quite know what to do with Paul. He doesn't quite fit into his picture of the lower class. He doesn't quite fit into the Roman citizen in a provincial city, on the other hand. And most people have not even been as confused as Deismann. They've simply said, early Christianity grows out of the proletarian classes of the city. It's a protest movement of the disinherited and so forth and so on. Until rather recently, an accumulation of studies of the Pauline language and of the controversies in the early Pauline communities, a whole series of different kinds of studies that kind of coalesced in what my colleague Abe Mel Herbie calls a new consensus, that the early Christians represent a cross-section of ancient society, that you have all kinds and statuses except the very top and perhaps the very bottom in the early Christian congregations. Robert Grant, in his little book on the social background of early Christianity that came out a couple of years ago, comes out flatly and says that early Christianity was a middle-class phenomenon. Well, it seems to me that that doesn't get us much further than Deismann. What do you mean, middle-class phenomenon? Where was the middle class in ancient Roman and provincial society? What do you mean by class, anyway? How do you define class? You know how Marx defines class in terms of access to the means of production. Max Weber defines it also economically in terms of chances in the marketplace. Neither one fits in antiquity because we have a totally different structure of the economic organization. And therefore, when we use a term like social class, we are very apt to be deluding ourselves, looking at the wrong thing. Therefore, to call the ancient Christians middle class is really to evade the issue. At this point, I think modern sociologists can really help us with their theory, because there have been a number of studies in the last decade or so about the way in which people locate themselves in the society and the way they're located by their neighbors. And these studies go back to something that Max Weber observed, that social standing is never measured by one dimension, but always by several dimensions. So that if I ask, what is my standing in the community? Well, gee, I'm a professional. And therefore, in terms of my occupation, I have a rather high rank. Ah, but in terms of my annual income, because I am a peculiar kind of professional, that puts me rather low down in the ranking. In terms of education, very high. In terms of family and location, very low. And so on and so forth. That is, if you want to know where you stand, you have to start listing a whole bunch of status dimensions in order to arrive at the overall status. This is a kind of unconscious checklist. When we get to know someone, these modern sociologists have found that one tends to want to put somebody in his place, but to find that place, we have to check off a number of different things. Now, some studies have been done more recently on Roman society, which have asked the same kind of question. What kind of dimensions count in antiquity? A man named Tony Riekmans, for example, went through juvenile satires and asked, what kinds of things does he satirize? How does he locate people? Well, there is citizenship. Roman. Provincial city. Medic. That is a non-resident alien. There is the ordo. This is the only legal measurement of status in the Roman citizen, Roman civilization. You have the senator. You've got the equestrian. You've got the decurion. That is to say, a member of the city council in a provincial city, or in a municipium, or in a colony. And then the other 99.9% of the population. That is to say, the middle class. The other 99.9% is the middle class, if you want to put it that way. You've got personal liberty, let's say. And here you have freeborn. You have freed in between. And you have slave. Wealth, speaks for itself. You have ethnic origin. Here the rule is the closer to Rome, the better. So you've got Roman. You've got Greek provincial. You've got the other provinces. And so on. You can list all kinds of things. Oh yes, of course. And male. Male. Not to leave out anything, they always said. The eunuchs. And you can go on playing this kind of game. Not only the amount of wealth, but where the wealth came from, which may be more important in some respects. With landed wealth, always worth more than mercantile wealth, just like in Victorian England. All right. Now, how do you arrive at the actual status of an individual? Should have put education up here. Occupation. Well, you can go on as long as, depending on how big your blackboard is. And all of these are important in the measure. Some are more important than others. So how do you weight these? You come to a man like, Let's take Gnaeus Bobbius. If you've ever been to Corinth, I know some of you have, there's this marvelous temple at one end of the forum, a round temple put up, and it has Gnaeus Bobbius in very large letters around here, gave this in response to his being elected, ideally, and so forth. And there are two or three other monuments. Bobbius got more inscriptions that have been found than anybody else in Corinth. He was obviously a very wealthy man. His son also gave a portico on one side, and so on. He's contemporary with the foundation of Christianity there. Gnaeus Bobbius comes from a Greek family. His inscriptions are all properly in Latin. His praenomen is now a good Latin one. He is evidently a freedman. He's got an extraordinary amount of wealth. He has relatively room for office. Well, he's certainly a decurion. He's first an ideally, and then he's a duumvir. So he has occupied two of the four central local offices in the colony. I have no idea what his education is. His son's education is high. So the next generation goes up a notch. But how do you weigh all these things, you see? Servile origin, he's a freed person, so that ought to put him low, at least in the eyes of the aristocracy. But that's true of almost everyone in Corinth, you see, because Corinth had been destroyed and then recreated from scratch by Julius Caesar, and he imported a bunch of Italian freedmen to be the colonists. And therefore, Gnaeus Bobbius, you see, probably belongs to the first families. His father probably came as a freedman, and therefore belongs to the established families who start things off here. But in Roman eyes, he's still a freedman and therefore is stigmatized. So you have one of these crisscrossing categories. Now, this is the kind of situation which and by the way, we can say the same thing of Erastus, the ideally, who was probably also the oikonomos de spolios mentioned in Romans 16, though nobody can prove that he was or wasn't. And you have this with a number of people who are probably mentioned in the Pauline letters. This is the case of what Moses Finley calls crisscrossing categories, but what the sociologists call properly the lack of status crystallization or status dissonance or status ambiguity. Now, what do they mean by this? They mean you can't simply take an average of all of these dimensions and say, all right, we'll give him 8 points here on citizenship, we give him 3 points here on education, 5 points on wealth. We add these all up and divide by the number, and that's his average status. It doesn't work that way, as you know. Some of these things weigh a lot more than others. Some of these things weigh differently depending on where you are. If you're in Corinth, they weigh one way. If you're in Ephesus, they weigh a different way. And the problem is that the way people look at you and the way you look at yourself is not simply the average of all these things, but rather is oftentimes the tension between things which are not the same. And in modern American society, at least, people who have a very high status in some categories, which is a characteristic of people who have been very strongly upwardly mobile, so that, as the sociologists say, they have high achieved status. They've worked very hard, and they've made a lot of money, and they've gotten ahead, and they have the status, but now the people down the road look down on them because they wear the wrong kind of necktie. They have high achieved status, but very low attributed status, because in those things which they can't change, those things which the society at large assigns to them on the basis of birth or legal ranking, they have low attributed status. These people in modern American societies will either become radicals, on average, or if it's the other way, they develop ulcers. There's actually been studies to count the number of psychosomatic illnesses of people of this kind of category and this kind of category. We don't know what happened to people in ancient society, but we do have a hunch that people who are caught in this kind of low status crystallization or status dissonance are going to be a little different from the people who don't have this kind of dissonance. We can't say how they would be different because we know that our society is very much different from the ancient society, and it's very much more introspective and so on and so forth. So it would be a mistake, it would commit the mistake of anachronism to project back on antiquity simply whole-bodied
the studies of voters in Detroit, for example, which is where Gerhard Linsky did a lot of this work to start with. But we can, at least, learn enough from Gerhard Linsky to ask this kind of question of antiquity. Okay. Therefore, when we talk about the status of the first people who became Christians, it simply doesn't make any sense to say were they upper class, middle class, lower class, for two reasons. One, because ancient society wasn't wired up that way, so that those categories don't make any sense. And second, because our society doesn't work that way either. The status that counts is very much more complicated. Therefore, what we need to ask about the early Christians is as many of these dimensions as we can think of. Where we have any evidence, where did they fit? Now, I try to go through and draw up a prosopography. It's a fancy term for getting the names of all the people that are named in the early Christian literature, and find out as much as you can about them from the text. There are about 65 individuals, not counting Paul himself, mentioned in the Pauline letters, leaving aside the pastorals because of all of the complicated problems about the pastorals, but the Pauline, Deutero-Pauline letters mention 65 individuals. You add to that the book of Acts, you get 13 more individual names plus an anonymous household, the house of the jailer in Philippi. Now you go through, and about a lot of these, you have only the name. And sometimes you can say, oh, it's a Latin name that might mean something, it might not. A lot of them you can say absolutely nothing about their status. If you discard all of those, you've got about 30 left that give some dim clue as to the status of the individual. Or sometimes a stronger clue. Erastus of Corinth, if he was, as I think highly likely, the same as the person who paved the theater floor, was a person of some consequence in that city. Prisca and Aquila from Pontus had migrated to Rome after being forced to leave Rome when Claudius expelled the Jews, set up shop with a household of their own and a household establishment large enough to take in another resident tent maker, visiting tent maker in Corinth, and then to move from there to Ephesus, and then from Ephesus back to Rome, and in each place having a church in their house, an assembly of Christians in their household. These are people of wealth. They are people who are mobile. But what kind of wealth? Mercantile wealth, which doesn't count very much. What about location? Jews? Doesn't rank very high. Greek province? They come from up in Bithynia, Pontus. So they're Peregrini. You give them a negative vote on that. These are people of very low status crystallization. Some very high status elements, some very low status elements. What went on in these people? Is there any connection between what went on in these people and their decision to become Christians in the Pauline communities? Or to turn it around, was there anything in the peculiar way in which Paul and his colleagues expressed the gospel which particularly grabbed that kind of person, gave to them a sense of reality which made them say, well, yes, that's the way I experience the world. That's right. That's what I've been looking for. I don't know how one quite answers that kind of question, but it seems to me it's an interesting question to raise. To this prosopographic evidence, then, one can add other kinds of evidence. We know that there were slaves in the Pauline communities. It wouldn't make much sense for him to say, as an example, as he's talking about the problem of the relationship between the sexes in 1 Corinthians 7, and then he says, and in the same way, if you were a slave when you became a Christian, it wouldn't make much sense if there were no slaves in the Corinthian congregation. Besides, we know that Chloe's people were members of the Corinthian congregation, and these evidently were Chloe's slaves. We know about Onesimus, a slave in a household. The household had become Christian. Onesimus had not until he met Paul again as a runaway in prison and then became Christian later. We know about one group of Pauline Christians who were members of the household of Caesar, probably in Rome. Some people think in Caesarea or Ephesus. And as I said before, this is the most upwardly mobile group in the early empire. We hear a great deal of emphasis on working with one's hands, especially in the correspondence with the church in Thessaloniki. We hear about living in hesychia, the quiet life, working with one's hands, minding one's own business. This sounds like the life of a group of artisans, hand workers, like Paul and Prisca and Aquila. It sounds like that kind of ethos. We have directions for taking up money to send to Corinth, from Corinth and the other Pauline cities to Jerusalem, and the ways in which that money is to be collected and saved gives us some insight onto the kind of money these people possessed, and how they got it, and what they thought about money. We have a great deal of commercial language used metaphorically in the Pauline letters, especially in Philippians. We have to ask, we have to be very careful about asking that kind of question, but we have to ask, among what kinds of people is that kind of language meaningful? When he talks to the Philippians about their partnership with him in the gospel from the beginning until the day, and how, and he gives them a receipt, you've now paid in full with this gift which you send me by Epaphroditus and so on. I refer to the new book by J. Paul Sampley, Partnership in Christ. This is commercial language, and perhaps more than that, almost legal language for a kind of relationship among people. What sorts of people would find that language meaningful? You have lawsuits going on in the Corinthian church, so you must have some kind of business dealings going on, which are important to these people. You have the conflicts between those people who have houses in which to eat and drink and those people who depend on the communal meals when the people gather for the Lord's Supper. And Paul castigates these people for dividing the community in this situation. It's clear that the conflict is between the haves and the have-nots, and so on. Now, my thesis is that if you add up all of these bits of evidence, you will find that indeed the congregations, insofar as we know them at all, show a mixture of strata. Christians come from most classes, perhaps not from the top 0.1% that were senators and equestrians and decurions. The only representative likely in that category is Erastus of Corinth. And perhaps not too many workers at the very bottom, the village workers who had only a subsistence living, were probably not affected at all by these urban congregations. So you leave out the very bottom of the pyramid and the very apex of it. Most of the other classes seem to be represented. And I think more important, in between, those figures about whom we can learn anything were themselves of ambiguous status, especially those people mentioned by name, and therefore who seem to have had some prominence and leadership role in the congregation, are people who are inconsistent in some dimensions of status. They are, if you will, social climbers. I find this exceedingly interesting. I'm not sure quite what it means. I would like to know whether there is any correlation between that fact and the peculiar dialectical quality to the Pauline rhetoric. I command you, no, not I, but the Lord command you, that man is not to separate from his wife, wife is not to separate from her husband, but if you do, then, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There are all these ifs, buts, and so on, which are kind of typical of the Pauline parenthesis. I'd like to know whether that kind of dialectic somehow correlates in any way with people who are of this ambiguous status, or congregations which have these strong tensions of status within them. I have only begun to try to see what kind of correlations there may be, but it seems to me that that is a more potentially fruitful sort of question to ask than to ask whether the early Christians were middle class or lower class, whether they were proletarians or middle class people.